Welcome to the Egyptian Streets podcast. I'm your host, Noron Morsi, writer and podcast producer at Egyptian Streets. Each week, we invite a notable Egyptian to talk with us as we explore the intersection between Egyptian identity and creative social change from an artistic, educational, or cultural perspective. Today, joining me as co-host is Mohammed Khairat, editor-in-chief at Egyptian Streets. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here as usual, Noron.
So today we have Merhen Keller as our guest, which is very exciting.
Yeah, so we're releasing this episode a couple of months after we first interviewed Merhen, who some of you may know, but for those who do not know, she is a businesswoman, an activist, and also a model. And I say this remark, you know, this time because since we recorded this episode, there's actually been quite a bit of discussion about a certain individual who plays football, as we'll discover throughout the podcast. So yeah, it's just interesting to, you know, have had that discussion with Merhen before the renewed interest and attention.
Yeah, the timing is very interesting. Stay tuned. Okay, hi, welcome to the podcast. What did you have for breakfast today?
Nothing, I haven't had breakfast yet. I have 3 kids and 5 dogs and a ruined mental health. So yeah, no breakfast.
Oh my God.
I think that's a very good start then. I think it's like right now for anyone listening, you know, I, Mohammed Khairat, the founder of Egyptian Streets, I'm located in Vietnam. Noron Morsi, the wonderful host of this podcast, is located in Egypt, and Merhen Keller is located in San Francisco, California. So mm-hmm. I think we're a very international podcast right now.
Yes, definitely. And probably I will not have breakfast at all. Probably I will have like a late lunch or maybe just dinner, probably. So my day starts usually at 5 a.m. in the morning, because I have to get some stuff done before the kids are out and about. So I need to prepare their food. I need to take the dogs out for walks, of course, because I have big dogs, like 5 of them, imagine. And they need to run. They cannot walk because they're big dogs. And then I have a little dog who needs to be walked by himself. And then I have to come home, clean, do the laundry and all the, you know, the mommy stuff. Although I'm not really a mommy, I'm trying. But yeah, this is how I start the day. Try to catch up on some news. I mean, now the elections is happening here, so people are even scared to go to bed and the results are announced. So we check on the news, see what's going on. I try to check my messages on social media to see if anything, you know, major happened or a disaster hit, which usually is the case. So that's pretty much a brief of what happens before the day starts.
So I think to clarify for everyone, I mean, you said to me previously that you do speak about your kids and stuff, but just to clarify, you have 3 kids, 5 dogs, and you work full time, and you're also campaigning for women's issues, running, you know, some very important campaigns in this past year. How do you do it all?
I have no idea. I really have no idea. I think part of it is me being Egyptian. You know that we always say in Egypt, for example, that some households run on a 500 Egyptian pounds and you don't know how. They have 3 kids. The kids are on, you know, taking private classes and, you know, they buy food and they buy clothes and you just don't understand. Mathematically, it doesn't make sense to me, but somehow it works. For me, I think I just do it. I do these things as they come. If there is a case or a cause, I just deal with it. If I have to be interrupted in the middle to do something else, I do it. But sadly, I'm not organized and I need to try to be organized. But the day cannot be stretched longer than 24 hours. You know? But it just happens. I think we're ruined.
You'd think someone like you would be very organized with all they have to deal with.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I can't. I think, you know what? Maybe it's better to use the word prioritize than organize, yeah, you know, most important to things that can wait, like my breakfast.
Fair enough.
That's yeah, I think that wraps it up nicely to the first question. I was gonna ask, so I think maybe this has a lot to do with how people were raised and how people's lives have been up until when they have to juggle all of these things together. So I was going to ask, what was your upbringing like and where?
Oh my God, no. My upbringing was the total opposite. So my mom and dad got separated when I was 12, probably. So half of my life is in England, half of my life is in Egypt, but mostly in Egypt because this is where my mom lives. And we stayed with my mother. And she was a very, very strict mom, like a typical Egyptian mom, but extremely strict. Like, I'm not allowed to wear perfume. I was not allowed to go anywhere by myself. I was not allowed. A lot of restrictions. My dad, on the other side, was the open-minded one who's Western educated, and he doesn't mind, and he wants me to get out and explore the world, thankfully. So I found somehow a balance between them both. Pacify them both, but I found a balance in between. My mom was a university professor. She just retired, and now she writes. My brother writes as well. He's a journalist, but he's a sports journalist, funny enough. And my dad was a lawyer, so he was usually busy, and he was also very interested in cases like the ones that I handle right now. So also part of that comes from my dad, I guess.
And so how'd you end up in America?
I have lived in 5 countries and I've been to 52 countries to visit. So the reason why I left Egypt initially is because I felt trapped. I felt like, okay, if I need to find the job that I want or I need to have the life that I want, I need to have a more relaxed environment. And back home, it was really, really difficult. My mom had her mindset on how my life was supposed to look. Like the rest of Egyptian moms, she wants me to get married and have kids and find a job home in Egypt and just live there until I die. But that didn't sound right to me. I just wanted to travel. I always wanted to travel. And I started to move from Egypt to England and then from England to Malaysia, from Malaysia to the UAE. And then I tried a little bit in between Kuwait as well before Dubai. And this is how it happened. I just decided to leave and, you know, try different things. And that's what I did. I tried many different jobs. You name one job away from the ones that are super technical. I'm not a doctor, for example. But any other job, I have done it. Being an accountant, a salesperson, retail, everything. I tried to do different things until I find what I like. And this is what I like. What I'm doing right now.
So how did your involvement with Egyptian, like, what some would call like the feminist Me Too movement, how did that begin? What was the first like encounter with that?
I honestly thought that I'm just being frustrated with one guy who sent me inappropriate messages, videos, they're very, very inappropriate. And I just wanted to say that this is not okay. While people in Egypt, even my friends are like, you know what? It's not worth it. Don't say anything. And I just felt like we normalize everything that we cannot change, or at least not even trying to change. We try to live with it as you know, part of life. And I thought at the beginning that maybe they are right. I'll just let it pass by. You know, I'm not going to comment. And then that person continued bothering me, threatening me, sending me people to my house to break my car, break the glass of my house. I was like, okay, that's it. That's it. I understand now the mentality where he's coming from. He's a male in a male-dominated society, and he feels empowered because he's rich and he's famous, so he thinks that he can do whatever he wants. And I also felt safe to start talking about that topic because he can't, I mean, I'm in a different country. I was living in Dubai at that time. So when I started talking, I was shocked that other women started a thread and they started sharing the messages that they received from the same person. Very similar in content. Threatening, sending, you know, unsolicited messages, inappropriate acts. And I was very, very happy as much as I was getting attacked from the other side, from men, people who were upset because that person is a football player. They thought, oh, this might distract him and we will lose the championship. And I don't know what else that they think is more important than our lives and our dignity, but it doesn't matter. And on the other hand, I have females who are saying, yes, that guy did this to me too. And I was shocked the amount of damage that one person can actually cause. These women created a thread that was trending How many women? He's like, what, 20-something years old? When did you even have the time to harass all these women? And then I started to think that imagine 5 men, 10, 1,000. This is why we are in this situation in Egypt, and somebody has to do something about it. And this is how it started. I think people started to know me from that unpleasant experience, but it worked out well eventually. It gave me a platform to use.
People who may not be aware, that was almost just over a year ago now, like a year. And so June 2019 was when, for context, it was at the during the African Cup of Nations, and one of the prominent footballers, Amr Warda, was accused by yourself and others, and evidence, of course, did come to light, of essentially sending unwanted messages, sexual advances. And shockingly, the Egyptian football team reinstated him, which was quite upsetting. After initially taking a strong stance, yeah, I think it raised a lot of questions. And I do think from, you know, there has been quite a lot of momentum since then with more women speaking about similar instances, especially from high profile people. But more importantly, this year, especially since June, we've had women speaking about everyday men who aren't in the public spotlight, such as with the ABZ Ahmed Bassam Zaki case that saw dozens of women accuse Ahmed Bassam Zaki of various sexual assaults, sexual harassment, and other forms of sexual violence. And you were one of the people involved in raising awareness about that case, but also subsequent cases. Have you seen a shift since that initial Warda case last year and how people are acting now?
Yes, I started to receive messages after the fact from a lot of girls saying, oh, that person bothered me in the street and I recorded him and I insisted to go and report him to the police. And I felt that women became more brave and they felt like, okay, I can do something about the situation, because we always felt like the prey. If he is close to you, you better run. But to see women who stand their grounds and try to record to have evidence, and they're thinking of ways how to protect myself. And I think the biggest part that I think changed a lot of things is the legal side of it. The laws in Egypt are very, very similar to the laws everywhere else in the world. We do have laws. And at that point, we also did have laws to protect women against sexual assault and sexual harassment, but females did not know that we have rights, you know, protected by the law. If I go and report that person, something is actually going to happen. And the family's pressure as well of, do not drag us into this. We don't want to go to court with people. What if his family tried to hurt us just to, you know, get back at you for reporting him and all that? But now girls actually do say no, even to their own families. When a mother or a father say no, don't do this, she said, no, I want to go to the police and I want to file a report. For me, that felt amazing, because those girls are like 17, 18. And then the movement happened again with Ahmed Bassam Zaki.
To be a bit more specific, what was your scope of work? So would you consider it social media activism, or do you have personal experiences with the people, the victims of these situations?
Yes, later on, when I started, I didn't have any experience at all in this field at all. It just happened by, you know, accident. I felt, okay, this is great. Now we have a platform. I'm having conversations with females. I have reassurances that, you know what, it's our problem now. A lot of women are complaining, so we can do something. But before that, I didn't have any experience. Later, I preferred to have a personal relationship with the victims. First, they reach out to me, usually, because I don't know a crime happened unless the victim comes forward and says something bad happened to me. And this is great, because I feel that they trust me enough to tell me something like that. And then I'm also required to ask questions, because accusation is an accusation until you can prove it. Even when it comes to something like rape and sexual harassment, believe women, we have to believe them as in investigate, to make sure that if this happened to her, she gets her right back. She has to, you know, get vindicated. But we have to investigate. So when I have a personal relationship with them, I can ask them questions and make sure that the story is valid and that person actually did this. We can start collecting evidence. And that taught me how to deal with victims because it's very, very difficult and sensitive.
And it's also interesting, too, I think, that your work has expanded to other areas, too, within a similar space, such as earlier this year, your campaigning for Amina Ansara Said and the capture of their father, Yasser, who was captured after the campaign.
3 weeks
and
after.
Three weeks after.
After something, how long was it? After like 10 years?
12.
Yeah. 12 years. Wow.
Yeah. And they told me he's probably dead.
And while he didn't end up being in Egypt, so the campaign was, you know, to promote, you know, awareness that this man is still out there, that he may be in Egypt, but also to bring light again the story after 12 years of the two girls' families and friends, you know, having no justice. I do think that increased attention definitely led to someone in the community noticing him or someone saying, hey, this man is here in Texas.
Even if the story they told is true, which I'm not buying, but I mean, again, it doesn't matter what I think. Even if the story is true, that person who would have called and tipped will not remember a face he has seen in a newspaper 12 years ago that he's wanted. It's impossible. It doesn't make sense. I mean, I cannot remember the faces of the people who were sitting right next to me yesterday in the restaurant having dinner. So to remember a face you've seen in a paper 12 years ago, you must have seen it recently somewhere else so that it looked familiar to you. Otherwise, it's impossible. So I'm so glad that this happened because now we understand what the social media is about. It's not just about the issues that happen in Egypt. It crosses over, and we have seen a lot of support coming from other countries as well. A lot of support, the media news outlets in the States, for example, put a lot of light on an issue in Egypt because people follow up on the news in America and vice versa now.
No, definitely. And I think for context also for everyone, so Yasser Abu Said was someone who 12 years ago murdered his two young daughters on New Year's Day in 2008. And earlier this year, after this campaign was launched, and I did notice a lot of Egyptian newspapers writing about the campaign and about the possible presence of Yasser Abdel Said in Egypt. The FBI announced a few weeks later that he was arrested in Texas, the same state where I believe the murder initially took place. I think a lot of people were incredibly confused how this man managed to stay hidden for 12 years and not even really hidden, apparently, because he was just living his life in the community.
Yeah. Yeah.
Apparently, someone called in a tip or something.
The FBI agent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the FBI agent, when I asked him, because I asked him a lot of questions, exactly the same questions you're asking right now, because, I mean, common sense, I was like, okay, the apartment that he was staying at, it must have been rented under somebody's name or leased under somebody's name. And he's like, yeah, it was under his son's name. And I said, well, that was not something that you think you guys should have started with, like to see his family members, if they bought houses or leased apartments or something like that to host him and hide him. And they said, yes, we checked. But this, again, this is part of all the secrecy that surrounds this case. There's a lot of questions. There was news in 2017 of a maintenance worker who has seen him somewhere and tipped the police. But when they arrived, they couldn't find him. And then again, in 2020, they said a maintenance worker tipped again the FBI. I don't know who is the maintenance worker. I would really love to meet that guy because he sounds like the real deal. He really catches killers like every couple of years, but the FBI can't. But I mean, at the end of the day, I'm glad that this guy is where he belongs now and he's waiting trial. That's all that matters. It doesn't matter. Those pickering and fight and how and where and when doesn't really matter. The truth is he committed a crime. They found him after 12 years and he's in jail now.
So some stories that you've worked on, some cases people have simply contacted you on Instagram. This case was a bit different though, right? This was through other work that you And can you go through like why or how this even came to be and what involvement was?
Yeah, it was. I volunteered with the Women's Rights Organization in San Francisco, and it just sounded right during the time of COVID. A lot of people needed help and they needed a lot of volunteers. And one of the victim's friends sent a request to Women's Rights Organization a while back asking for the case to be, you know, supported and for us to give them help to reopen the case and follow up with the FBI and see what's going on, because nothing happened.
Is real change happening, though, do you think? Like real structural, deep-rooted societal change?
Definitely. Taking into consideration that Egypt is so, I mean, we are one of the oldest, if not the oldest cultures in the world. And we have certain beliefs that are so deeply rooted in our heads and in our conscience. So having said that, the change is actually happening faster than I expected. I thought there would be a lot more resistance than that. And when I say that, I'm talking about the society. I'm talking about families, Egyptian families. Now we have mothers and fathers who understand what we're talking about and are actually more careful, and they ask their daughters questions if they feel suspicious. This is a huge change. Everything in any country changes with the people, not with the law. People change the law later on. But now we can actually see a lot of change. Every time we talk about a case and it's something like very serious, we see movement from the government. The public prosecutor always immediately issues arrest warrants and he gets those people to investigate what's going on. So now people feel even more safe and more empowered. Like, if I talk, I'm not going to get in trouble. If I said that this person did something to me, he's the one who's going to get in trouble.
Do you think that could be temporary change or because of the burst of the movement, like starting this summer? Or do you think that this can be sustained for long-term change, and how do you think that could happen?
No, certain things don't go backwards. Like after we discovered fire, we will not go back to the pre. We cannot say that the era of discovering fire is just temporary and is going to go away.
You've mentioned change in the families and in society and whatnot, but is that limited to the middle and upper classes, you think, or has it somehow trickled down to the lower classes? And I don't mean to talk about class in this upper, lower, middle, but in Egypt, I guess, you know, we have that whole class system.
Yes, it's classified as such. Yes, of course. So we have to discuss it as such. I think my family comes from a mid to probably lower class, not high class or upper class. You know, if I have to choose a positioning. So, for example, my grandmother's house is in Sayda Zainab. So I'm always there. My brother is always there. And we know the neighbors. We know the area. And in this neighborhood, you will find people who are middle class and people who are not. And I can see that the situation is completely different because I get messages from my old neighbors. And, you know, they tell me, oh, my daughter said this and this to me. And I'm so proud of you. Lots of people actually contacted me from our neighborhood to tell me that, you know, I've heard about those cases and it happened with me as well. And I spoke to my mom and my dad today and they decided to go and file a police report against that person. You know, in Egypt, we are emotional people and the family values are very strong. We always even refer to our kids like Ruhi, Albi. We're very, very emotional. And it doesn't matter what social standard you are. Your kids are everything you have, everything in your life. You would die for them. So you will never accept somebody to harm your child or touch your child or even scar your child emotionally and cause them any kind of anguish. So our parents think that the abuse is exclusive to them. They can verbally abuse us, but nobody else can.
Following the Ahmed Bassemzaki case in particular and the attention that received, I think there was a lot more focus on, are we making it easy for people to report crimes generally, not necessarily just sexual crimes, but crimes on a general basis? Whether or not it's, you know, effective, that's more of a long-term kind of study that will need to be looked at. But the progress that's been made has been important, I think.
So now that there's been these movements and people know that there are people you can reach out to and that they're not alone,
What do you think the next steps are in this movement so that it's not just a trend that dies down eventually?
I think definitely the media can play a big part in that. And I'm not talking about social media. I'm talking about actual media, because the young people have access to social media. They know what's going on. But we need more of that to reach our families, to reach the moms and dads sitting at home. They don't really have access to social media, but they watch TV, they watch the news. And I think the government can really highlight these issues and air it. Like, for example, those initiatives that happen every year with cancer hospital and other, you know, initiatives. This could be one as well, so that people at home can be educated. And I think the focus should be on children as well right now, because if we educate them from an early age in school, that males need to understand that you're not supposed to touch, you're not supposed to harass the female, and also educate the female what she can do if something like this happens. Then when those grow up, we will not have these problems anymore. So definitely the focus should be on schools. We should, inform parents or have parents meetings and make sure that this becomes an essential part of our education system. Definitely. I mean, I think it's a specific class, maybe even sex education, should be in our schools. It's definitely important, so they can understand the difference, they understand consent, they understand respect and boundaries, and then we can definitely be all free of this burden.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame because a lot of these solutions sound very, you know, obvious.
Yeah.
But they just aren't happening.
Merhan is mother to three adopted children from Gaza in the occupied Palestinian territories. She was kind enough to share with us her experience with them.
It happened when I went to Gaza with the relief mission. And that was last year. And the situation was really bad. And I was visiting some hospitals. And the doctors there told me that there are two children who live in the hospital. And I didn't understand how. And they told me that because they lost their families and the doctors gave them a room, basically, in the hospital to live. And that was the most heartbreaking thing for me for one reason. There's so many kids who lost their families. You know, it's not something that we've never heard of. But those kids had absolutely no knowledge of the outside world. They don't know what a car is. They don't know what, you know, it's heartbreaking to feel that they lived in a box their entire life and they don't know what's happening. They only know that it's not safe out there. There's shooting, there's killing, but I don't know why or what happened or what's going on. They only know that they were lucky enough to be alive, unlike the rest of their family members. So that was very tricky. Any organization that deals with these issues sadly doesn't have a lot of Arabic speakers, and that is so horrible because those kids are terrified. They have people who speak a language they don't understand, placing them in places they don't know, and it's just the unknown. Their whole life is about not knowing. And I stayed there for 2 weeks, and I was seeing them every day just to sit with them, talk with them. And they started to warm up to me and laugh. And I felt like this is amazing, because if they feel comfortable enough to laugh, then it means that we're getting closer. And then I asked help of my friends. I have Mike Clark and his wife, Laura. They work with the organization here as well. And I told them, listen, if you do this for me, I will do anything for you. I'll be your slave forever. But please, if you can help me bring them to the States. They did help me a lot. And I remember Mike was even expecting his baby. His wife was giving birth at that time. And yet he left and he traveled with me to get them. And he said, well, if I'm having a child, then I should do better than that. And I respect him a lot for it. He did all the paperwork and he spoke to, you know, the governors because Trump had some restrictions on accepting, you know, things like that and bringing people and giving them residency. So I asked them if they would like to come with me. I showed them some pictures of my house and my dogs. And, you know, I'll be your big sister until you guys are old enough to take care of yourself. And I think they agreed because they felt like, okay, you know, especially Iyad, he's the eldest. And he is extremely smart. It's scary. Like, seriously, he keeps correcting me all day long. And I love it because he didn't speak a lot before. But now he can stop talking and I love it. And... These are my kids now, you know, so this is what we came here to the States, and I enrolled them with, you know, therapists to make sure that, you know, this area is taken care of also properly, because I'm not an expert and I don't want to make mistakes. So we go to therapy together. They go by themselves, and then we go together as a family to explain to us how and what to do. They love the dogs, and they started, you know, taking classes. So they start catching up. They're doing amazing. I mean, especially speaking English. But yeah, they learned really fast. And I was like, oh my God, when did you learn to speak like that? But this is great. They take self-defense classes as well. They love it. So yeah.
I think that's a very inspiring and incredible story. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's really admirable.
I got lucky with them. I really got lucky with them, because they do for me more than I actually do for them, believe it or not. For real. I mean, especially Iyad, for example, he would come and say, you know what the problem is that I'm smaller. Like, I'm strong. I can defend you, but I'm smaller. But it's only a matter of time it's going to happen. And they're absolutely loving it here. I was really worried because San Francisco is a bit, you know, quiet at the moment. And I was thinking, I brought them from a closed place, hospital, to, again, a closed house, because I'm worried about COVID. I'm worried about, you know, a lot of things happening, the riots sometimes. But they really embraced it, and they love it. And they make me do things that I never did before. I haven't sat on, like, in a park on the grass literally ever in my life. Ever. And I was like, how the hell didn't I do that before? This is amazing. Yeah, seriously. And all my friends are like this. They keep telling me that I'm a pushover, but I'm not. I'm glad to experience these things with them. And I'm not that old. It's like they act like I have to be an authority figure all the time, but I don't think that this is what they need. They need both. You know, they need to be loved a lot, and they need some structure in their life. But they are good kids. They're very polite, you know, they do their homework, and they're very bright. So I see them doing awesome.
How old are they?
9 almost now, actually, because we got the paperwork. Because before that, I wasn't sure. The doctor said 7, 8, you know, something like that, because they didn't have any documentation like birth certificates or things like that. And they don't know. So 9 now, 3 and a tiny baby. Newborn. Yes. It was crazy. I honestly thought initially that they would agree to give me Muhammad, because he's a baby, but I was really worried, and I was even thinking, what if they accepted just one? How is it going to be? And I asked Iyad at that moment, and he said, no, we will not leave. We leave all together, or we will not leave. And I respect that. He's like the man of the house right now.
I'm sure he's gonna, you know, like that. That's just an incredible story, and I think, you know, you're giving them such a great opportunity to, like words cannot describe. I think before we wrap up, I think a good question to ask: what is one message, one lesson you've learned that you'd like to, I guess, spread to other people?
Do it. Every time I speak to someone, I always tell them, do it. If you're in the street and you see something that you don't like or a situation, intervene. Don't even think for a second before doing it, because a lot of people tell me, and even guys, they say, I'm always worried if I interfere and I see a girl being bothered by someone, that she will say, oh, it's none of your business why you're talking to me, or she will embarrass me as well. It doesn't matter. Think about it. Embarrassed, or that woman ends up getting raped. It doesn't matter, okay? Do it. If you see something wrong, fix it. It is very, very powerful. We've made a full circle. One of my friends actually took a screenshot of Twitter when it was Amina and Sarah's case, and he sent it to me saying, look what I found on Twitter. I think this is something you might be interested in talking about. And then I didn't see the message immediately. And then he checked the screenshot that the person posted is from my profile. And he's like, oh, never mind. I thought that this you didn't know about, but it's your post. But you see how strong people created a massive network away from me. He didn't even know that it's me. And yet he told me. So you will tell your friends, and your friends will tell their friends. And this is when things happen, not when Mehen talks about it. Definitely not.
Well, thank you very much, Mehen.
Mehen, if people want to find you online, read your stuff, your Instagram, where can they find you?
Yeah, my Instagram is my name as I write it exactly, Merhan Keller. And that's the platform that I use mostly.
All right. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. This was a very inspiring podcast, and I'm really excited for everyone else to hear this conversation.
That concludes today's episode. Thank you so much to our guest, Merhan Keller, for joining us today, and for my co-host, Mohammed Khairat. Mohammed, what do you think of this episode? I thought it was really... I mean, I didn't know Merhan before we talked to her, and I thought she was definitely a really interesting person.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was quite an energetic episode. I think Merhan was a very energetic person, which also is reflected in her social media presence more generally. I actually was personally really invested in learning more about her personal life and how she manages to juggle, you know, being an activist, being a model, being a businesswoman, with her family duties as well. I think that is a really important story, and it shows you, you know, that if you have that passion, if you have that drive, time, you kind of just make it.
Yeah, I loved how it was. She was showing a three-dimensional view of who she was, because obviously this is like cliche, but on social media we always see the not even like just the good sides of people, even more like the way they're working so hard or the way, but we never see the full picture. And I feel like with these episodes, especially with Merhan, we could see like there was this whole backstory of her kids and the adoption and all of that stuff, which was really, it was really heartwarming. And it was also really eye-opening to like that.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, yeah. I mean, another point also was that, she mentioned a bit about her own background and her upbringing, and, you know, she wasn't always necessarily able to do the things she does today. And I think that's also an important, I guess, message from all of this, that often the people that you're looking up to in these positions were in the same position as you are, or are in the same position you are. I think that's that was great to touch on as well.
Definitely, yeah. Egyptian Streets is a podcast produced for the independent online publication at EgyptianStreets.com. The show is edited and produced by Noron Morsi. Production support from the Egyptian Streets team. Our theme music is The Zeppelin by Blue Dot Sessions. Tune in to the Egyptian Streets podcast every other Sunday, and don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening. I'm Noron Morsi.